Jones at CBS News. In retirement, I return to my roots in non-commercial radio, making programs like this one.
My name is Victoria Ketty, and you are listening to WGXC, ACRA, 90.7 FM.
Greene County's Mountaintop Cares Coalition has announced it once again offering training to administer naloxone and Narcan, the saving drug used to reverse opioid overdoses. The medication is easily administered by a trained person. The training is virtual and takes approximately 2 hours. It will be held online from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Thursday, January 21st. All participants will be issued a Narcan kit upon completion of the training. To register, write naloxone at mountaintopcarescoalition.com, or you can call 518-487-1788. The Coalition is a nonprofit organization that serves people with substance abuse disorders and issues of addiction in the mountaintop communities of Greene County. Its mission is to promote recovery and empower those we serve and their families through advocacy, referrals, education, and peer support.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXE sustaining supporters who provide critical monthly support. Thank you.
WGXE is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tunstall Studio Publishing of Craryville, New York. WGXE's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXE as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXE Newsroom, this is the WGXE Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Bethany Bump reports in the Times Union the latest foul-up in New York's vaccine distribution plan. New York's Office of Information Technology Services said January 14th that someone shared an unpublished link to schedule appointments for COVID-19 vaccinations at several state-run sites without authorization. That had New Yorkers signing up for vaccine appointments at sites that have not even been opened. Marcy Stevens, General Counsel for the Office of Information Technology Services, said, and I quote, "We are currently contacting everyone who used the unauthorized link to inform them of the situation," end quote. Stevens did not say who was responsible. To get a COVID-19 vaccination, call the state's vaccination hotline at 1-833-NYS-4-VAX. That's 1-833-697-4829. Or go to the state health department's Am I Eligible website. The rollout of the vaccine locally has caused many problems from federal, state, and county officials who have increased eligibility while vaccine doses are scarce, open telephone hotlines that are forever busy, or where calls go unanswered, and presented chaotic information to the public about distribution. The Daily Freeman reports Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan said January 14th that a lack of COVID-19 vaccine locally could mean Ulster County temporarily halts inoculations this week. Ryan said about their Kingston distribution location, and I quote, "Every time I walk out of there with a great sense of both optimism and hope, because we are putting hundreds of vaccines in folks' arms, I also walk out of there with great frustration, because that site has much greater capacity and it is not being used right now. That site could do up to 1,500 dosages a day, but we're well below that," end quote. Ulster County received 2,100 doses of vaccine last week, and none so far this week. Ulster County reported 112 newly diagnosed cases of COVID on January 14th, and Dutchess had three more deaths for 43 in January. Plus, Dutchess County announced another 273 positive tests. On January 14th, both Greene and Columbia County reported at least 50 new coronavirus cases, the first time that has happened. There were 165 new cases in Rensselaer County, and Albany County reported 273 positive tests. Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Greene Media on the details of now former Catskill Village President Vincent Seeley's resignation, which are now emerging. The five-term board member submitted his letter of resignation on January 8th, and the full board accepted that resignation Wednesday, January 13th. The board will now select an acting village president to serve until the post can be filled in the March 2022 elections. His departure comes after being absent for months. Village Vice President Joseph Kolowski said the decision to ask for Seeley's resignation was tough. Kolowski said, and I quote, "Being he was absent for so many meetings, we've had questions from the public asking him why he hasn't been attending. So we asked what his intentions were, and he said, if needed, he would send us a letter of resignation. We asked if he was going to miss more meetings, and he said he might, so we asked if he could tender his resignation, and he did so," end quote. Kolowski commended Seeley for his efforts. Board members all lauded Seeley's dedication over the years and said he would be missed. Seeley said in his resignation letter, and I quote, "It has been a great journey, and I believe I left the village better than I found it and in the very capable hands of the current village board and staff. Many years ago, we coined the phrase, welcome to the ever-improving village of Catskill, and I believe that still rings true today," end quote. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Melanie Lekasevic is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media. The New York State Board on Electric Generation sitting and the environment has granted the next level of approval to Hegate Energy Albany, the developer of a 40-megawatt commercial solar farm proposed for a 400-acre site between Routes 9W and 101 in the town of Coeymans in southern Albany County. The sitting board okayed a certificate of environmental compatibility and public need on January 7th. Once built, the project is expected to generate approximately 73,000 megawatt hours of energy annually. The project will generate up to $3.6 million in local property tax revenue over 30 years and create 140 construction jobs, according to the developer. Hegate filed its public involvement program plan for the project in 2017 and held its first informational open house in Coeymans in 2018. Coeymans Town Supervisor George McHugh welcomed the board's approval. McHugh said, and I quote, "I'm very happy that the state sitting board approved the solar farm slated for Coeymans," end quote. He went on to say, and I quote, "This green energy project will result in greater tax revenue for the town, county, and school district," end quote. The project was not without opposition. Staff at the Department of Agriculture and Markets opposed the use of prime farmland for the project, but the sitting board unanimously approved the developer's certificate. Once completed, the Coeymans Solar Farm is projected to generate enough clean energy to power 8,000 average-size homes a year. And you can read the full story in the Ravenna News Herald. Azra Haqui is reporting for the Times Union. Nominations are now being accepted for the Jefferson Award for Public Service. The prizes have been given since 1972, honoring ordinary local people who do extraordinary things for others in the community. For the past 15 years, the Times Union, St. Peter's Health Partners, and WNYT have worked together to honor volunteers in the Capital Region. Past honorees have given countless hours to improve the lives of refugees, taught educators about LGBT, volunteered during disasters, advocated for Alzheimer's patients, organized trips for children of color to learn about their heritage, established an arts venue, helped with substance use disorders, supported people who have experienced sexual assault, created awareness of domestic assault, work to improve their neighborhoods, and have helped veterans. Finalists are celebrated in the spring, and then one person is then selected to represent the region at the National Jefferson Awards Ceremony in Washington, D.C. in June. The deadline for nominations is February 23rd. Information is available at 518-454-5792, and you can read more in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grand. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, January 15th. 26 degrees in Hubble Corners, 32 degrees in Gayhead. That difference in temperature is going to be important tonight. More on that in a second. The day will be dry and clear with calm winds. Grab your sunglasses if you go out and maybe haul in some firewood if you're staying home, because overnight it gets nasty. Rain and or snow starts after 7 p.m. Riding both sides of the freezing point, down at sea level we'll see mostly rain with some mixed snow, leaving no accumulation by morning. On the mountains, that story changes and you could see a foot of snow by morning. Snow can easily descend the mountain if temperatures waver, so just be aware of that if you have to travel. Light rain continues through the day tomorrow as temperatures jump into the 40s for everyone, melting what fell, and refreezing overnight, making some crunchy snow for Sunday. It will be windy with a high of 42. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:24 a.m., low tide 10:46 a.m., high tide again 4:40 p.m., low tide again 11:23 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:33 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:17 a.m. Looking way up, we see an incoming solar wind is expected to strike on Monday. Solar wind speed is currently 295 kilometers per second at 1.6 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2, quiet. There have been 12 days since the last sunspot. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate. Be safe out there, everybody.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Christian Hayes of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
After missing many meetings over the fall and into the winter, Catskill Village President Vincent Seely resigned. He claims credit for calling Catskill the ever-improving village. Several years ago, Catskill musician Brian Dewan wrote his own song called Our Ever-Improving Village. Here is that song.
This is a song called The Ever-Improving Village. And Pepto-Bismol sunset tips aslant and seeps into the water table like a sewage treatment plant. A rust box swings and screeches on which feral children play. Their hollers strain through chain link fences all the mean dog day. Hang a left at Colonial Drug, the local den of sin. Kitty corner across the street from the horse and buggy motor inn. A crooked mile past Murderer's Creek, just north of Indian Head Hill, lies our ever-improving village on the banks of Thornbush Kill. The powers that be won't likely vote for doing something rash, like plow the streets or fill in potholes or pick up household trash. They raise the ban shell for being an attractive nuisance, so they say. Then they tore down the public library for being old and in the way. They put a wub mart up invoking eminent domain in hopes it will kill off the local business that remains. Yet once there was an ordinance that you couldn't build no higher the statue of William Penknife or the Second Parish Spire. Things aren't so bad, they're getting better. We're not so bad, we're getting better. Things aren't so bad, they're getting better. We're not so bad, we're getting better. Instead of loitering round the liquor store, the wayward youth will enter our state-of-the-art brand spanking new juvenile detention center. Get your kicks at the 5 and 10 or the 12-lane Polydrome. The ace of burgers, the rummage roost, or the gloaming old folks' home. We've got the county's largest junkyard, which truly does deserve to be declared an accidental wildlife preserve. In spite of all you've heard about the underground oil spillage, you've got to admit we've got a heck of a view from our ever-improving village. We're not so bad, we're getting better in our ever-improving village.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 transition and uncharted territory.
Just as we respect and will protect peaceful protesters, we will also just as vigorously resist violence.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and other state leaders are beefing up security after FBI warnings of possible armed protests leading up to the inauguration. Organizations that track right-wing extremists say there's online chatter planning more violence. Utah Governor Spencer Cox says they're preparing.
We are bringing in all of our reserves that we can with the Highway Patrol. They will be ready this weekend, and the National Guard will be on standby.
To improve safety in flights to and from D.C., the TSA is increasing security screenings and some airlines are banning guns and alcohol. President-elect Joe Biden announced his American Rescue Plan last night, nearly $2 trillion to pull the country out of the economic crisis, including $1,400 direct stimulus checks, $160 billion for a national vaccine program, a $15 an hour federal minimum wage, and billions invested for education, childcare, nutrition programs, and more. On a call yesterday, incoming First Lady Dr. Jill Biden told military families she's ready to work with them to relaunch Joining Forces, a support program she co-founded with First Lady Michelle Obama.
This has been an incredible time for Joe and me, and the weight and the beauty of this responsibility, of the trust the American people have given us, will never leave me.
Meanwhile, Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney survived Republican calls to remove her from GOP leadership. The number three House Republican voted for President Donald Trump's second impeachment. Some Republicans that supported Trump's rejection of the election now say impeachment will further divide the country, but the path to unity goes through accountability, say others. California Democrat Ted Lieu on the House Judiciary Committee told NBC, quote, "We cannot heal as a nation without first having justice," unquote. Chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Benny Thompson in Mississippi, agrees.
You don't resolve the lingering stink that this administration has created by just saying it's over.
Thompson also wants Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Josh Hawley of Missouri punished for leading the effort to refuse certified election results without credible evidence. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of a handful of Republican senators who have signaled they would at least consider the arguments of both sides in the Senate trial. No date has been set.
Donald Trump was a disaster for human rights.
Ken Roth heads up Human Rights Watch, which released its new World Report 2021 this week. He says Trump dismissed refugee rights, empowered white supremacists, undermined LGBTQ rights, revoked environmental protections, and eroded the democratic process, along with America's credibility.
Even though there was an occasional U.S. condemnation of human rights in Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, sometimes China, these rang hollow when there was parallel praise bestowed on the likes of Russia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or Israel.
The report urges Biden to establish a worldwide commitment to human rights that can't be easily reversed by future successors. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
So this was supposed to be a very nice press conference, okay? My last one on my first term, we were going to announce some very strong pardons. And then all of a sudden, the Democrats, with a little help from very weak Republicans, sort of came out with Impeachment Hoax 2, the sequel, okay? And like a lot of sequels, except for Home Alone 2, this one's a whole lot worse and more pathetic. But it's a total disgrace, and we don't know what's going on with the inauguration next week because there was some, right, Mike, irregularities, they're called irregularities, that's what we're saying, we're being nice. But we're going to do it very peacefully, okay? We are a party, you see, hypothetically, if this would happen with hypothetics, and they were to steal an election, I would say burn the country down. I would say burn it to the ground. But I'm not saying that because MAGA is a party of peace, strong peace, tremendous, long-lasting Republican MAGA peace. So we don't do violence, okay? I might do violence on you. You're lucky that you're getting out of here. You know, I see fake news appointed a nice, pretty young woman to take your place. I wonder why, so Sleepy Joe doesn't have nasty you to deal with, right? Right. Okay, hopefully you're unemployed now. But I was going to issue some strong pardons. Now I have to do it very quickly. Everybody at the Capitol Hill, Patriot Party, total pardon. Ghislaine Maxwell, total pardon. And Bill Barr, in case anybody ever happens to find some emails instructing him on how he might get rid of Jeffrey Epstein. So that's it. And we have one quick letter from my now dead doctor, rest in power. Donald Trump not only is super healthy, but is also the most well-endowed patient I've ever had. And those were his last words.
And we have Jennifer Hicks, who is the founder director of 11 Jane Street, an arts incubator and exhibition space in Saugerties. And Jennifer is also an artist, too. Is that right, Jennifer?
That is right. Yep. Artist and performance artist.
Well, so tell us a little background about 11 Jane Street. When did you get started and what do you do?
Well, first of all, thank you and good morning to everybody. It's been a very dramatic couple of weeks, so I appreciate you taking time to
say the least. Yes.
Yeah. So what we do is, I'm an artist. I've been an artist for a long, long, long time. I was a member of this performance collective in Boston called Mobius for 10 plus years. Did my MFA in contemporary performance at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. Undergrad at the School of Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So I've been very interested forever about how fine arts and performance art, sound art, dance, all work together. And so when I got the opportunity to buy this building, a very old, dilapidated, fabulous building in Saugerties, 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, my thinking was to turn it into a very cool space for artists to come and work on new work, experimental work. It took me a lot longer to renovate it than expected, just as these things go. Anybody who's ever done this kind of thing, you know, once you start unwinding an old building, you find more problems than you had known were there. But that being said, we opened officially 2019 with a fantastic show by Millicent Young, which is an installation piece and then a 2D piece. We also have guest curators. So Jen Dragon was a guest curator for a few months for half of the gallery. We've got two galleries. We've got Gallery North and Gallery South. And then the way the space is laid out, Gallery South is primarily for sculpture and 2D work. And Gallery North is designed specifically for performance. We've got a, which of course, you know, we can't do much right now with COVID, but we've got a sprung dance floor. We've got blackout curtains, sound panels. So sound artists can come in and do work and kind of control the sound, how it bounces around. And the idea is to have artists who can work on cross-disciplinary platforms, so sculpture and dance, or sculpture, 2D work, and film, and spoken word, or sound art. So that's the mission.
Wow. The as a radio station, I we're super interested in the sound, but the dance floor is a rare commodity locally, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why this place is really unique. And it's not huge. It's 6,000 square foot, so it's a good amount of space. But it's an also an intimate space, which means the artists who are coming in have the opportunity to do some new work, experimental work that they could take somewhere else and do, you know, an enormous space. But they can get the immediate feedback from the audience. And then the audience has the luxury and gift and however you want to word it to meet the artists and have direct contact with them and communication with them. So that's cool and unusual.
And of you're one of these a little bit sad stories of some great new institution opening in the area and immediately has to shut down.
Yes. It's okay though. I mean, I hate saying it like it's fine, but I'm not going to be whining about it. Everybody's gone through this. So I'm not alone and you guys are dealing with it too. And you know, what I think happened in a strange way is that it forced everybody to slow down and regroup and be creative. And that's what we do in the arts anyway. So yes, we had to shut down for a few months, but in that time we shut down, we shifted some of the artists' shows around and keeping the spirit going as we're going to keep going forward in a different way, maybe. But that's okay. We'll keep going.
Just the art sector of live performances in person is just one of the most devastated sectors because of the pandemic. Because yes. there's basically nothing you can do except do these online things that are, especially with dance, I would assume are unsatisfactory.
Well, again, I think we just have to shift our paradigm of what we are used to, really. Well, I mean, I can't do an art opening per se anymore. So we changed it to doing an all day open. The gallery's open and people come and go. It's a long day for the artists because they're there all day. But it allowed, again, people to come in and talk to the artists in smaller groups. So they had more intimate contact with the art and the artist and see the art with space around it. And the same thing has been happening for the performances, where we haven't had a lot of performances, but we've done some work outside. Tracy Cockrell did this just fantastic piece where she takes typewriters and reconfigures them and plays them as a musical instrument. And so we did a piece with, she did a piece, and the audience was spread out. So she does something called a poem-a-phone, where she will play these typewriters, and it worked out great. It just has to, shift your attitude and move people around and have less people, which is unfortunate, but that's what we got to do.
How were you received in Socrates as a experimental venue coming to upstate New York?
That is a really interesting question, because I was a little concerned, honestly, like what are they going to think of this? But on the other side, the reason I moved to Socrates from Boston and I was teaching in Colorado is because I knew a lot of people up here. I knew a lot of venues. I knew a lot of artists. It's an incredibly creative community. And so I was really well received. It's really well received. We have a steady group of people that come in, and always new people. The community is very supportive. And then, of course, we've got folks coming in from the city. You know, a lot of people are moving here from Manhattan, Brooklyn, LA. So it's been a good process.
So other than the once in a lifetime pandemic, everything's going wonderfully, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's a challenge. I'm not going to say it's like a piece of cake, but it's, I am, this is the good side and the bad side of also being an artist. I am not a well-trained business person. I am learning as I go. So I'm learning a lot. I'm learning about just how to run a business. I'm learning how to run renovations and a gallery and meeting new artists and keeping up with so many interesting events and people and things that are happening. And so it's challenging, but it's fun, you know.
Tell us, we're speaking, if you're just joining us, with Jennifer Hicks from the 11 Jane Street space in Socrates. Can you give us the website if people want more information?
Sure. It's www.11jane.com, and Jane is J-A-N-E, so it's 11 J-A-N-E street spelled out .com.
And tell us a little bit about your work as an artist too.
I am a Butoh dancer, of all things. I studied Butoh for 40 years almost now, 30 some years. Butoh is a Japanese, it's a movement art form based in Japan, or came out of Japan in the 1960s. Started people know Kazu Ono or Hijikata, and the work is, to say it very simply, is taking poetic imagery into movement. So you can work with images, you can work with feelings, you can work with kind of sounds. So I'm not describing this very well, but it bottom line is taking poetic imagery into movement. So that's where I have been doing my work for a long time, but then also working with sound artists. So because it's a movement piece, I do a lot of collaborations, and then taking that into the installations that I build. And recently I've been moving more into painting. So the show, I actually have a show in April. I'm going to open up the season. Hopefully, you know, knock on wood, we'll be able to open in April. I'll be doing a Gallery South is going to be a painting show. I'm working on the idea of kind of roses as a theme for healing, and the performance, I'm building these kind of glass or plexi domes, and I'll be working with sound artist Gary Weisberg, and I don't want to say too much because I'm not 100% sure how it's going to come together yet, but it'll be a dance movement performance with sound and collaboration with Gary. So there you go.
So that's great that you're planning a season this year. So how do you foresee your season being? Or are you still unsure because we're all sort of unsure? The vaccination rollout has been slower than anticipated and has had some problems, but everyone is itching to get back to some sort of normality.
Yeah, and we're plowing ahead. The plan is, and as of now, we're still going to keep going. And I have a show, and I'm going to open up the season. Then we're going to Norm Magnuson, who is a visual artist as well as a performer. Renee Moncato is coming in from Manhattan, Elizabeth Keithland, and Colin Chase. And then we have an opening in November that I'm going to put a call out for artists. So all you people out there in Radio Land, if you want to send me information about your idea, I am totally down with hearing about it. So you can go to the website and sign up at the website. And send me stuff. I'd love to see what you're doing.
And the space is large enough that you have people in it sometimes?
Yeah, we do. It's really amazing. We have doors and people can come in. They can look in and they can say, okay, too many people in there, I'm not coming in. But generally, it has a really easy flow. So it hasn't been a problem where it's feeling claustrophobic and you know, we can still maintain social distancing, and of course you have to wear a mask when you're in. And then for the performance stuff, we're doing some online. For instance, Erica Berland and Wendell Beavers have an artist residency right now, and we do a 3-month residency this year, so it's January through March. And they were going to come and stay. I have a residency house across the street, and they were going to come and work directly in the studio, but due to traveling restrictions, COVID and whatnot, they are remaining in Colorado, but we're doing a link between where they are in Colorado and 11 James Street, so people can sign up for their classes. So they're doing online classes and online performances. So you can find that also at the website.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has been giving State of the State speeches all week, and the second one he gave on Tuesday was focused on the arts. I'm wondering, it's probably hard to tell for you, but as a new arts place in Saugerties, have you seen any evidence of your local impact on the town?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, the arts are, as I said, the arts in Saugerties are great. We've got Emerge Gallery. We've got various other galleries that are in town. There's a Saugerties Arts Commission. Barbara Bravo runs the Saugerties Artist Studio Tour, which has 41 or 46 artists involved. And it's as I said, it's a fantastic supportive community of each other. So it just gives another platform for people to express themselves. For the town to get exposed to different artists, so they're not all necessarily local. I've brought an artist in from New Orleans last year, 2019 also, Andrew Newman came in from Boston. So to answer your question, it's a feedback loop, you know. The village comes, sees work, the artists get feedback, and then the village gets exposed to new and interesting artists, and it goes like that. I have to also give an enormous shout out to Linda Montano. Linda Montano is one of my absolute art heroes, and she lives in Saugerties. And Linda Montano, if you don't know her, she's one of the seminal performance artists in the world. And to have her have my back is just enormous. So I just want to say that she's here, and so many fantastic performers and musicians and artists are right in the Hudson Valley.
And I'm guessing too that you have a large event and the people stream out of it, and some of them probably go down the street to bars and restaurants back in when you could do that in your first year, I guess.
That's also a nice perk. Yes, that's true. Again, when we have COVID restrictions lifted, that would go back to somewhat normality. But we also have a lovely coffee shop next door, which is part of 11 Jane Street. It's the building is part of 11 Jane Street. I own the building, but the coffee shop itself is Olson and Company. And you can go right into Olson and Company, have a nice glass of wine, have some lunch, have some dinner, come back, look at some art, walk around the village, go to a Merge Gallery, go to look at the shops. Great. It's a lovely little town. It's great. I mean, Inquiring Minds bookstore is right here. So it's a place, it's a destination place.
And how has it been with your very local government, with your state government? I guess Cuomo did talk about the importance of the arts in reopening the economy the other day, and the federal government. I guess there's something in the new stimulus bill that helps places that have live performances or not. How has been and dealing with all the bureaucracy, how has that been for you guys?
I'll say for myself, because my venue is so small and I'm just trying to get on my feet, I'm not really worried about it, honestly. It's different than a music venue. It's different than the Colony, for instance, or somewhere where they need people to come in the door in order to survive, and buy and go to a show and, you know, eat food. We also have art that's for sale. So that is the other piece of what we do. And so it is a gallery, and again, I think it's okay. It's people are still out and about. They're coming in, and it will change, and COVID will go away eventually, and we'll be back to doing larger performances.
Have you noticed?
A little weird answer, but that's the best I can give.
That's okay. Have you noticed? And maybe it's too soon to tell, but do you think art is going to be changed by this in any way? Or have you noticed artists already reacting or changing their practices or their styles? Or have you seen any impact in the actual art?
Yeah, and that's also a great question. A lot of artists, I'm not going to say all artists, but a lot of artists are used to working independently. And so when you have to kind of go inside and hunker down, artists are used to that. They're used to, even if they work with a group, they're also used to working solo. So what I feel like happened was it sort of cleared the slate for everybody to just slow down and take stock in where they are and look around them and get more of a sense of in solo, but also the larger community. And the conversation I've had with a lot of artists have been about just that, like slowing down. Where are you? What is important? And setting priorities.
Yeah, it seems like even we talked to a lot of business people, and there's been a lot of reassessing and time to like think about like, well, why am I doing things this way? Do I need to continue to do things this way, or should I think about doing things this different way? This year has been like forced reflection upon people.
Absolutely, and other. Some people are frozen by it too. I know some artists who just, they had a period where they just couldn't work. They couldn't figure out like, what's the point? Why am I doing this? What, like, nobody's coming to see the art. I can't get out. I can't see anybody. And you can spiral down very quickly. And so I think that in that spiraling down, a lot of people found the core of why they do art again and spiraled back up in with that new kind of jewel in their pocket and you know, reinvigorated as to why they make art in the first place.
Yeah, it seemed like we've gone through a couple of different phases. The first phase, there was COVID brain, where we were all kind of mush, and just if you looked on Twitter, it was filled with typos. Like amazingly filled with typos because nobody's brain worked properly.
And then, I never thought of that. You're 100% right.
And then the summer we got to get outside and clear our brains and everybody was a little more mentally healthy. And then now we're, I don't know what's going on now. I mean, the numbers are, and the cases are worse than ever before. And people don't seem to, be taking it with the same, seriousness as in the, when it first started, but there's been these different reflective periods where you think about everything, and I don't know where I'm sort of rambling off now, but
I know that there's been this conversation again with a lot of people that I know of dying. Like, okay, this, we now are as a world are faced with the reality that a lot of us could die in 2 weeks. Bam, you're just gone. And what does that mean? And it's terrifying. And I think that is what really reset a lot of people's thinking. And of course, there's people that are going to deny it, and then they're, you know, it's not real and blah, blah, blah. But the majority of people that I know, they did retake stock in where we are, your family, your loved ones, why we do what we do, how do we continue to support each other as best we can. How do you support the larger community? How do you fit into the larger community? Or do you? Or it's just all these questions that have come up. So I think it's oddly, I don't want to say COVID was positive, but there's something that has reset. And there's also a lot of very angry people. And that is the disturbing part to me. Of why and how that can change. I don't know.
So we're speaking with Jennifer Hicks from the 11 Jane Street exhibition space and incubator in Saugerties Arts Incubator. So how optimistic are you about the future of 11 Jane Street and I guess Saugerties in general and the Hudson Valley art scene in general?
I'm really optimistic, honestly. Again, as we were saying before, with this spiraling up and down, I mean, there's been moments where I'm just going to cave and say, I can't do this. This is too much. I'm overwhelmed. I can't do it. I have a new assistant who is off the hook. Fantastic. Shout out to Catherine O'Mara, who has just been a gift to help me with kind of all the stuff that needs to happen. And so we're moving in a really good direction. And I feel very optimistic. Yeah, we're going to keep going.
All right. Well, why don't you give out the website again and any other information you want people to have if they want some more information about 11 Jane Street.
The website is www.11janestreet, spelled out, street is spelled out, .com. Yeah, we have an artist residency going on now. We'll open up again in April for the exhibitions, opening with me, Jennifer Hicks, and then we have Norm Magnuson, Renee Moncado, Elizabeth Keithland, Colin Chase, and we have an opening in November, and we're going to be putting a call out for artists. So stay tuned for that. And you can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. And give me a shout out. Say hi. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today and telling us all about 11 Jane Street and Saugerties. And we hope to visit soon.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. And keep doing what you guys are doing, because I love that you're out there. You're doing experimental stuff, and you know, you're cutting a path for all of us to come with you. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. That was 2021 new music from Emily Ritz, her song Door Watcher from the album In Love Alone. Thank you.
That was Jazz from Food Man. Here's Uxto, both songs from the Ex Minzoko album, 2016, new music from Food Man.
My name is Victoria Ketty, and you are listening to WGXC, Accra, 90.7 FM.
Saturday afternoon, January 16th at 4 p.m., tune in Orlando et la Tempête Virile Symphony Redux Suite by Joseph Nechtival and Andrew Deutsch. The Virile Symphony is drawn from the novel Orlando, written by Virginia Woolf in 1928. And is featured on the Saturday afternoon show from 4 to 6 p.m. January 16th on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Michael Alterman of Cairo, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, January the 15th, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. Paid family and medical leave programs have been a source of relief for those who have been sick or caring for loved ones during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now Eric Tegedoff reports Washington state lawmakers would like to see it go further.
Lawmakers hold a hearing today on House Bill 1073, which would expand the program to more people, especially low-wage workers. State Representative Liz Berry introduced the legislation, the first of her career in Olympia.
Knowing that we're going to be dealing with that throughout the remainder of 2021, I think it makes sense to treat this as a priority emergency legislation this next session so that more workers can enjoy it.
HB 1073 would change the qualifying threshold so more workers can access it. It also would expand the definition of family and ensure that small businesses with fewer than 50 employees protect workers' jobs and continue their health insurance. Since the program began in 2020, 170,000 workers have applied for benefits.
That bill will have a public hearing in the House Committee on Labor and Workplace Standards. Now to New York, where nurses at the Albany Medical Center say they feel vulnerable to exposure to the growing spike in COVID-19 infections, and they're struggling to keep up with the patient load. For months, nurses have complained the hospital was reusing N95 masks as many as 20 times. Michelle Hanna is an ER nurse at Albany Medical.
You have to have a special fit test for N95s. And there are entire units in the hospital that have not even been fit tested, yet they're still doing aerosolized procedures on patients of unknown COVID status.
For its part, Albany Medical Center says masks are inspected before being reused or destroyed, and employees don't have to reuse masks if they don't want to. The movement for reparations for Black Americans has seen greater urgency since the police killing of George Floyd last year. In the state where he died, the effort to make amends has taken a big step.
This week, the St. Paul City Council unanimously approved a new commission to look at ways to produce financial reparations for descendants of chattel slavery who live in the capital city. Commission co-chair Trarin Cruz says the region's history of racial injustice can be traced back to Dred Scott and his wife, held as slaves at Fort Snelling. And Cruz cites another well-known example of hardship for Black Minnesotans.
St. Paul is home to the Rondo neighborhood, which was a thriving Black community, which had Black businesses and homeowners, which was wiped out due to the construction of the 94 freeway.
Cruz says many of the injustices are still being felt today and were brought to light by the pandemic and the racial reckoning of 2020. I'm Mike Moen.
Other U.S. cities that have taken similar steps to consider reparations include Evansville, Illinois, and Asheville, North Carolina. This is PNS. With the Colorado legislature back at work this week, the state's largest union of educators is calling on lawmakers there to increase funding, make classrooms safe, and help attract and retain top-notch teachers.
Amy Baca-Ollard with the Colorado Education Association says she's looking forward to working with lawmakers to ensure that educators get the resources they need to provide students with a quality public education, regardless of their zip code or the amount of money their family earns.
In a time where we are trying to address the needs in a global pandemic in educating our students, we need the legislature to prioritize funding for our students and for our public schools.
Last spring, lost revenues in the economic fallout of the public health emergency led to state lawmakers increasing what's known as the budget stabilization factor, or the amount the state would underfund public education, to more than $1 billion. I'm Eric Galatis.
And groups that advocate for water quality are urging the incoming Biden administration to meet the goals of the Clean Water Act. That would mean reducing what's known as nutrient pollution in the Ohio River.
After the last 4 years of federal water regulation rollbacks, 10-plus groups filed a petition asking the EPA and Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, or ORSANCO, to take immediate steps. Hank Grady with the Sierra Club says nutrient pollution poses real threats, including harmful algae blooms, which damage drinking water systems and sources. He warns if agencies continue to put off regulating levels of nitrogen and phosphorus,
we'll have more and more harmful algae blooms. They'll happen more frequently, because there'll be more and more fuel for them, and that will make the river less useful and more dangerous for all of us.
He says this is the third petition to set nutrient loading regulations over many years. I'm Lily Bulkey.
Finally, sticking with what you might call the H2O beat, the Colorado River is the lifeblood of the American West, but the viability of that river basin is being threatened by climate change. Mark Richardson reports the state, federal, and academic scientists are teaming up for a closer look.
To plan future water use in the region, which includes Arizona, the Central Arizona Project is teaming up with NASA and Arizona State University to evaluate how climate and land use changes will affect patterns of hydrology. ASU professor Enrique Vivoni says their work will help apportion future supplies of Colorado River water.
How will we as society in the western U.S. that depend on this hugely important river basin, adapt to changes that will come to the basin over the course of the next 50 to 100 years.
The scientific modeling will identify water flow patterns in an area where water rights have long been contentious.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, heard on great radio stations across the nation, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Graham. Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Green County Paramedics President Mark Evans said with the addition of a fifth paramedic vehicle to Green County's fly car system, response times have been significantly reduced on the mountaintop. Acquisition of the paramedic vehicle that prepares patients for transport prior to the arrival of an ambulance was approved by the county legislature in November 2019. Evans said of the new vehicle, which went live in April, and I quote, "It's been going exceptionally well. Having that truck there has saved several lives," end quote. Before the addition of the new vehicle, response time on the mountain were approximately 5 minutes longer than the 9-minute response time in the valley. Legislator Harry Gardner, who represents Hunter, was pleased with the quicker response time. He said, and I quote, "I could not be happier. I want to thank all involved in having this happen, Green County EMS Mark Evans and everyone else and our legislators for seeing it through," end quote. Huntertown Supervisor Darrell Legg said the car has, and I quote, "been a godsend, really," end quote. Prattsville Town Supervisor Greg Cross said the fly car made all the difference this summer, helping to save multiple lives. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. News10.com is reporting Dollar General will pay its workers to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Its employees will each receive the equivalent of 4 hours of wages if they choose to be vaccinated, according to reporting from the Wall Street Journal. The Tennessee-based Variety Store is one of the first large employers to pay employees to receive the vaccine. The company has 16,720 retail locations in 47 states and more than 157,000 employees. Experts say employees can require workers to take safety measures, including vaccination. That does not necessarily mean getting fired if the vaccine is refused, but the employee might have to sign a waiver or agree to work under specific conditions to limit any risk posed to the workers or to others. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has allowed companies to mandate the flu and other vaccines and has also indicated they can require COVID-19 vaccines. There are exceptions. People can request exemptions for medical and religious reasons. Dollar General has stores in Greene and Columbia counties, including locations in Greenport, Athens, West Coxsackie, Cairo, and Palinville. And you can read the full story at news10.com. CNY Central and WHAM-TV are reporting in the third installment of his State of the State address Wednesday, January 13th, Governor Andrew Cuomo focused on the development of green energy technologies in New York. In addition to addressing climate change, the governor said transitioning to a green economy will also provide crucial economic benefits for the state in a post-COVID world. He said, and I quote, "Today, I believe the stars are in line for real progress if we connect the dots," end quote. The governor outlined 4 goals for building a green economy statewide. Identify projects that can adequately support energy needs in New York, stop relying on other countries for green energy supplies, and produce them here in New York. Build transmission capacity to help connect places where energy is generated to locations in need of it, and train and educate a workforce that can meet the demands. Cuomo said all four goals must be accomplished simultaneously. He announced 26 private and public sector partnerships aimed at starting 100 renewable projects throughout the state, with 68 projects already underway related to solar and on and offshore wind projects. Cuomo also proposed what he said would be the largest wind energy-focused project in the nation. Also announced an effort to help train the green energy workforce, including the development of a $20 million offshore wind training institute. And you can read more at cnycentral.com. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, January 15th. 26 degrees in Hubble Corners, 32 degrees in Gayhead. That difference in temperature is going to be important tonight. More on that in a second. The day will be dry and clear with calm winds. Grab your sunglasses if you go out, and maybe haul in some firewood if you're staying home, because overnight it gets nasty. Rain and or snow starts after 7 p.m. Riding both sides of the freezing point, down at sea level we'll see mostly rain with some mixed snow, leaving no accumulation by morning. On the mountains, that story changes, and you could see a foot of snow by morning. Snow can easily descend the mountain if temperatures waver, so just be aware of that if you have to travel. Light rain continues through the day tomorrow as temperatures jump into the 40s for everyone, melting what fell, and refreezing overnight, making some crunchy snow for Sunday. It will be windy with a high of 42. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:24 a.m., low tide 10:46 a.m., high tide again 4:40 p.m., low tide again 11:23 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:33 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:17 a.m. Looking way up, we see an incoming solar wind is expected to strike on Monday. Solar wind speed is currently 295 kilometers per second at 1.6 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2. Quiet. There have been 12 days since the last sunspot. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate. Be safe out there, everybody.
You know, I was listening to the radio, and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM. Listener-supported radio.
Hi, Laura Kuhn here, director of the John Cage Trust, bringing you a deep dive into the intriguing life and work of Renaissance man John Cage, celebrated composer, poet, philosopher, chess pupil of Marcel Duchamp, life partner of Merce Cunningham, macrobiotic chef, exponent of Zen, visual artist, and avid and pioneering mycologist. Tune in to All Things Cage, 7 p.m. Saturdays beginning January 2nd, for conversations with Cage experts and enthusiasts from around the world, right here at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, and via the web at wavefarm.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Shane Burley is the author of the book Fascism Today: What It Is and How to End It. He writes on a range of political topics, and his work has been published by Truthout, NBC News, Al Jazeera, and other publications. So, Shane, just this week, two noted historians of fascism, both experts in their field, Timothy Snyder and Robert Paxton, called both Donald Trump and the attack on the U.S. Capitol last week as fascist. You've written extensively on the far right and fascists over the years. How did we get to this point, and were you surprised at all by how events unfolded last week?
No, I wasn't tremendously surprised. I think what both the experts you mentioned are picking up on is the kind of paramilitary quality of it. And I know that Paxton specifically had cited a certain unwillingness to call Trump a fascist without having sort of a paramilitary squad there to back him. And this kind of appears as such, and I'm sure that's probably true in the Snyder analysis. I think the way that I might differentiate from that is that I don't necessarily, I think that the ideological tendencies are there even when they're not fully manifest. And so what's happening here, it's been largely called a coup attempt, but I wouldn't say it's organized enough to necessarily call it that. It has a little bit more impulsivity to it, and it organizes itself a little bit more like a social network. And so that has been building, well, you know, at least for the last 5 years of Trumpism, but even longer into the Tea Party and beyond that in just kind of far-right populist movements, let's go back decades. So this was all that kind of impulsive, seemingly spontaneous, but not entirely spontaneous kind of acts of violence and Trump's connection to it has been there for a very long time now. And so there should have been nothing surprising about a president who has cultivated a cult-like violent following than saying that a conspiratorial cabal has taken over the government. I mean, that just logically would precede acts of semi-organized violence from the followers.
In last week, so there are members of the fascist street gang. I know you've written about the Proud Boys and other Trump supporters attacked Black Lives Matter activists and counter demonstrators in Albany. And in the brawl that ensued, one anti-fascist stabbed some of the Proud Boys in an act of self-defense. He was later arrested by the police, and a Black Lives Matter activist was also brutalized and arrested by state police that afternoon. And this happened, you know, the same time that the siege on the Capitol in D.C. happened. But none of the Proud Boys were arrested by the police, and counter-demonstrators feel like the police essentially enabled the violence of the Proud Boys. So I think this incident sheds light on a national trend, and one certainly unfolding right now in D.C., that law enforcement is much more lenient in responding to violence or the threat of violence from the far right and fascists than they are in responding to protests and movements, you know, on the left, even peaceful ones, and that there is a definite crossover and even in some instances coordination from both vigilante fascist groups and law enforcement. Can you talk about this and tell us what trends you've noticed and written about both nationally but also in Portland where you're based?
Yeah, I mean, the police play kid gloves with the Proud Boys. It's not only the Proud Boys, most far-right groups. In general, there's a lot of historical reasons for this. I mean, the vigilante, white vigilante groups are not disconnected or at pure odds with the police. This goes back for a very long time, where law enforcement tacitly either above ground and clearly above ground ways or in covert ways or even just in ideologically congruent ways will support these far-right groups as sort of the guardians of the social order to a degree. I think that sometimes people look for explicit coordination as the evidence of it, or they allege explicit coordination when I think that in a way white supremacy is more insidious than that, in as much as a largely white police force that who is structurally there to maintain systems of property, white supremacy, only have the ability to see themselves in more of a collaborative relationship with far-right groups than with left-wing groups. They literally have more ideological overlap. They have more constituents that overlap. They speak a more of a common language. The far-right groups there try to coordinate with the police. So there's just a lot more reasons why the police tend to see allyship in the far-right, and they won't see it in the left, who also sees the police as enemies. So it's sort of built into the structure of it. There's been a lot of kind of reports about the police basically saying they see like far-right groups as more mainstream than left-wing groups, where their police unions, the largest organizations that are propping up police interests, are basically supporting the same ideological positions as the Proud Boys. There's a lot of reasons why the Proud Boys are not getting treated with that kind of force. There is also a certain type of historical clash between the police and white nationalist groups. This is out really heavily in like the 1980s and early 90s with the militia movement and police busting them up and kind of FBI stings on white supremacist groups. But that was specifically around their open revolutionary politics. And with the Proud Boys, they work a little bit differently. A lot of the groups that we saw in Washington, D.C., that's from the Capitol, works a little bit differently. They actually see themselves as quote-unquote constituents of the existing country to a degree rather than having a kind of very explicit, open revolutionary politics. That may be changing as Biden takes office, but that historic, that those moments of clash between the police and the far right aren't really happening right now in the same way. That, like I said, that nice shift has the Biden administration changes the perception of what the government is in these groups. I guess we'll have to see with that. But I think what's happening is that the common narrative inside the Proud Boys is also the one that's inside police departments. Conspiratorial views of Black Lives Matter protesters and Antifa, a real confused understanding of what's real and what's not. QAnon is just blazing a trail through police departments right now. So I think we need to understand that there's enough commonalities there that we cannot expect that police departments are the comprehensive solution to dealing with something like the Proud Boys. They never have been, they never will be.
So how dangerous and volatile is the current political moment, and how does it compare to past fascist movements either in this country or in other countries?
Yeah, I think some of the conversation, I think, is a little bit wrongheaded. There's a couple of reasons why. One is that that people are using the term coup, they're using the term violent insurrection, they're using the term terrorist, even though they really shouldn't. And I think they're doing that for reasons that are not very accurate in some ways and not very useful in others. They do it largely to try and position Trump supporters with the same rhetoric that Trump supporters have positioned the left to say, oh, actually, these are the rioters. These are the insurrectionaries. These are the ones that are dangerous to law and order, right? And so what they're doing is essentially capitulating to a right-wing vision of the world and then ascribing the enemy's status to this group of people. And the problem is that they are much more diffuse, less organized, and less of have any kind of cohesive political agenda that you might see historically in like a fascist party that you might have had in the 30s or something. So it's not really a one-to-one comparison. That being said, none of them are one-to-one comparisons because it's 2021 and the world doesn't work the way it did in fascist coups in years past. Social movements work profoundly different. For example, party politics aren't as important. Neither are formal organizations. Mass movements develop themselves through different metrics. They coordinate differently. They think of themselves differently. They identify themselves differently. And so a large-scale kind of insurrection that could lead to a revolutionary moment would look more like it did in Washington, D.C. or Minneapolis or somewhere than it would look like the beer hall putsch. And so I think that we can't just analogize it to something else perfectly. I think what's most dangerous right now is not that they're about to overthrow the government. I don't see a lot of evidence that that's the case. I think what's dangerous right now is the normalization of far-right violence as legitimate political action beyond just theater. That's important. The message of desperation that's going on in the far-right right now as a kind of combination between losing the election and the escalation of conspiracy theories leads to like seemingly impulsive acts of violence, kind of what people call, maybe rightly or wrongly, lone wolf attacks. That's, I think, a really big fear. I think that the narrative that these people are the rightful defenders of like the American project and that project is under attack from, who knows, communists, Antifa, whatever, that is really dangerous because that leads to these kind of violent interventions. I think that's the framework in which we need to understand it, not as Trump right now is going to successfully stage a revolutionary coup on the government. I mean, the American state is a very large military apparatus, and I have yet to see it be able to be taken in that way. Instead, it can shift, and state repression can be an immense part of that shift. But I do think that sometimes we capitulate to what we think will be rhetorically useful in talking about far-right groups instead of trying to see them as accurately as possible.
So what advice do you have for people in effectively fighting both the far-right and, far-right populist and fascist movements?
I mean, I think self-defense is a critical piece of that. I think community coordination. I mean, it's in a way it's kind of boring because the answer I give to people is to organize in organizations that exist. I mean, that's the most important thing, is to look at what organizations exist, find ways of connecting them and creating intersectional analysis and collaborate through coalition building. Those are the important things. You know, we have organizations that exist. We need to be able to pivot them so that they have self-defense components where they have the ability to fight. This happens on multiple fronts. We can't just defend against the Proud Boys in the streets, but we absolutely have to. We have to be looking at a kind of border imperialism. We have to be able to look at what's happening in workplaces and ecologically. Like, we have to connect those together. And so I actually think that imperfect action is better than perfect inaction. And so I think that people need to see where they're at, see what they're good at, see what they like doing, and then to take action like that. But you always have to have a rear guard component to it. Anti-fascism is not just a movement in itself. It's what protects all movements going forward. And it's even more than that. It's what protects the impulse towards creating liberation. You know, one of the things that white nationalism is about false promises and about the kind of twisting and perversion of the impulse to destroy that which you think is destroying you. And so anti-fascism is absolutely critical, just like having a core sense of anti-racism and opposition to patriarchy. You have to have those as being a core fundamental feature of an intersectional movement that's built on coalitions.
Thanks so much for joining us, Shane.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ahead of more possible unrest this weekend at the state capital in Albany or the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., WOOC's Elizabeth Press spoke with Lexis Figueroa of All of Us about his arrest at the New York State Capitol on January 6th.
Next, I'm joined by Lexis Figueroa, a Saratoga organizer with All of Us. We are recording this interview just hours after the House impeached Trump for the second time, this time on incitement of insurrection. First of all, Lexis, thank you for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And second, I was wondering if you had a reaction to this news.
Thank you. Yeah, my reaction is, obviously, I'm pleased to see that. He's done nothing but cause a lot of division in our communities, and he's been bad news for the country. You see what's going on right now. See what happened last Wednesday at the Capitol, the insurrection. That was, it's crazy. He's got to be stopped.
And speaking of January 6, 2021, this was a day where white nationalists created an insurrection in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol. Here in Albany, there was a rally in support of Donald Trump as well and a counter protest. And you were there. Talk about what that scene was like last Wednesday here in Albany.
It was a little more wild than usual. There was about 35, 40 of them. A few of my friends ended up going there to check out the rally. We were countering the protest, meaning we were just going there to voice our opinions, how we don't believe in what they're saying, in the lies and the rhetoric that they're spreading with the falseness of the voting in the elections. I got there when there was a commotion going on, actually. The commotion